From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2012 Democratic National Convention. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Washington. We just heard from Senator John Kerry, Democrat of Massachusetts, and also the 2004 Democratic nominee for president. He talked about Mr. Obama's foreign policy and national security record, something we haven't heard much about in either party's convention. We're working our way up to the big speech tonight from President Barack Obama, who will accept the nomination for a second term. Right now, I'm joined by Bill Burton. He's the co-founder of Priorities USA Action Super PAC. Before that, he was a deputy press secretary in the Obama White House. Welcome to you.
Hi, thank you.
Your super PAC has been struggling. By one account, a pro-Romney super PAC raised about four times as much. Why do you think Democratic contributions are lagging?
Well, for a couple of reasons. I think, number one, Democrats just fundamentally don't like super PACs. They don't like outside groups, and they think that the system needs to be reformed, which is something we agree with and the president agrees with.
In fact, didn't the president for a while say he didn't want people giving to these groups?
Well, you know, I was a spokesperson in the 2008 campaign.
Oh, so that was you.
Yeah, so that was
Do you regret
saying,
that now?
Listen, folks, don't give to these crazy groups. No, it's, you know, it's a different environment now. The Supreme Court changed the rules. And the fact of the matter is Karl Rove and the Koch brothers have hundreds of millions of dollars that they're going to spend trying to defeat the president. We got involved because we think, I know it's National Security Night, so to paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, you go to Election Day with the rules you have, not the rules you wish you had.
But if you're being so much outspent, how crucial, how much of a difference is that going to make in the election?
Well, being outspent matters, but keep in mind that President Obama has been living in people's homes on their TVs for the last 6 years approximately. And they have their opinions of him. They sort of have a relationship with him. Mitt Romney's a new guy, and educating people about his record and where he wants to take the country is a much less expensive endeavor. So it actually costs a little less to do what we're trying to do. And if you look at what we did over the spring and summer, we spent $20 million, which is about a tenth of what was spent overall. But we had a real impact on the race, whereas, you know, Republicans spent $157 million or so, and it's hard to see where they move numbers anywhere.
You know, there was a recent New Yorker article, I'm sure you've heard all about it. It talked about how Mr. Obama just hates schmoozing donors, and he's really offended some. He just kind of hasn't done the niceties many of them expect. That must make your job more difficult.
Well, look, anybody would love for their principal to do nothing but spend time with donors, courting them, talking to them, hearing their concerns, things like that. But as it turns out, President Obama's very busy being the President of the United States and Commander-in-Chief, and I have no problems with him doing his job. Well, I go out there and do mine.
Can you tell me, how do you decide? So you take in the money, you run, the main thing I know about is running TV ads, right?
Yep.
How do you decide what kind of ads, what they're going to say, what you're going to focus on?
Well, we're very driven by data. And what we decide, we actually had a meeting December 7th of 2011, Pearl Harbor Day, where we decided that we knew that Mitt Romney was likely to be the nominee. And we knew that he was going to make his business experience a central argument for why he ought to be president. And so we decided we would talk about his business experience and make sure that voters were educated about all the different facets of it. And we went out, we found folks who knew something about it, and talked to them, had them talk on camera about their experience with Mitt Romney. And those ads have been very effective. They don't scream at the people who are listening to them. They don't get overly intense. They just say the facts about what they know about Mitt Romney.
So is your plan to attack Mr. Romney more than his running mate, Paul Ryan?
Well, you know, people almost never vote for or vote about who's the running mate on the ticket. A big exception to that is, of course, Sarah Palin. And, you know, I'm glad that Mitt Romney picked Paul Ryan because it does make this more about policy. But it also was the one vice presidential pick that could have had any negative impact on the ticket at all of all the different folks. Even so, Romney's the guy at the top of the ticket, and we're going to be very focused on him.
Mr. Obama has mentioned a possible constitutional amendment to ban these kinds of super PACs, which some consider kind of an unrealistic thing. They don't see how that would happen. But do you think they will ever be gotten rid of, or are they just here to stay?
Well, you know, I certainly hope that they are gotten rid of, to be frankly, and I get the irony of me running a group that I think shouldn't exist, but the rules are what the rules are, and the only way that we're going to get reform is if President Obama is elected and can fight for reform. Because if Mitt Romney is elected, it basically just underscores the fact that, yes, rich people, a small group of rich people can get involved, spend hundreds of millions of dollars and have an impact on the race for the president of the United States. And there's no reason to think that they would spend less money. You know, you come 2016, they're probably likely to spend more money.
All right. Bill Burton, co-founder of Priorities USA Action Super PAC. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And I'm back now with E.J. Dionne, Matt Continetti, and Washington editor for NPR, Ron Elving. Last night, former President Bill Clinton really brought the House down. E.J., how can President Obama continue that momentum?
You know, I was down on the floor earlier, and I was talking to somebody about this, and I decided that President Obama is so competitive, so deeply competitive about everything, that to have Clinton do a great job and Michelle Obama do a great job is actually good for him.
Especially,
Michelle.
He can't.
Especially Michelle Obama. By the way, you know, I was down there. This crowd is so fired up that they would cheer a bad weather report, a grocery list, or somebody reading from a phone book. I mean, this is an amazing crowd. And it reflects what the convention is. And this is a very tight race. It's really striking for somebody accustomed to, I've been to a lot of Democratic conventions, and it was noticeable they had the roll call for Joe Biden, you know, all in favor, all opposed, not a single dissenting voice. In the history of the Democratic Party, it's unimaginable that there wouldn't be somebody who'd dissent on everything. And so that's one of the striking aspects of this convention. And on Bill Clinton, you know, he went long. And the thought I had today is for people who like Clinton, it's like your favorite rock band. You want them to play the long version of their songs. And that's what this crowd was like. He could have talked another half hour and they would have been happy.
Free bird. Yes. Free bird.
Ron Elving, can we work in just a little bit of fact-checking here? Because we keep hearing tonight as well this number, 4.5 million private sector jobs that have been created under President Obama. Can you give that a little context?
All right. When you say private sector, now you're
well,
getting a little
close. Well, I guess someone probably left out private sector, didn't they?
Well, exactly. And private sector it is. And that, of course, is good. This is the sector that drives the economy, the one that we heard a lot about in Tampa. And that's been dampened to a large degree by the loss of public sector jobs. And public sector jobs have gone down because government has been downsized at the federal level, at the state level, and at the local level. And that's something we didn't hear much about last week in Tampa, the shrinking of the public sector. Now, maybe it's time for that. The voters seem to want that. The voters want a smaller government. They want to spend less money on government. And that means laying off government workers, which affects the unemployment rate overall. So that's been a real drag on the overall numbers, even as the private sector, as the president once rather clumsily put it, is doing, you know, fine or something like that. The private sector was creating jobs, the public sector was losing them. Of course, the private sector is not doing nearly fine enough by anyone's measure, and we're going to find out just how weak it is in terms of robust recoveries of the past tomorrow morning when we get the August jobs report. No clear indication of which way that's going to be going, but I don't expect it's going to drop below 8%, and it's 8.3% now. It could tick up, it could tick down a little bit, but it's not going to drop below 8%. And historically, we've never seen a president reelected with anything over 7.5% unemployment. So this remains the big dark cloud over this convention.
Just
okay.
A couple quick
Actually,
things.
Actually, so sorry, EJ, always have to cut you off. I'm so sorry. We're going to dip down to the floor to Sonari Glinton to tell us what's happening now. Hi, Sonari.
Hey, I'm standing on the floor, and retired Admiral John Nathan is giving a speech, and all across the back of the floor, delegates are holding up thank you signs. There are, it's getting a little loud, they're a group of veterans who are standing on the stage, and the Democrats here in the hall are showing their appreciation for the vets. There was just a video right before they came out that talked about foreign policy, about killing of Osama bin Laden, about the accomplishments of the president. And so right now, what you're hearing is the ending of the tribute to the veterans.
Okay, thanks, Sonara. And NPR's Debbie Elliott is also on the floor somewhere there. Hey, Debbie.
Hi, I'm here. And I'm with a couple of, I guess I would call them convention curators, who are here from the Smithsonian, Larry Bird and Harry Rubenstein. And they collect memorabilia from conventions. Mr. Bird, how long have you guys been doing this?
Well, I've been doing it since 1984. First convention I went to was in San Francisco.
So, Mr. Rubenstein, if I look over here at the Texas delegation, I see some great cowboy hats with buttons on them and some red, white, and blue attire. When you look at a delegation like that, what are you looking for in terms of what you want to curate?
Sort of the same thing. I mean, what we're trying to do is capture a little bit of the enthusiasm and the excitement and the whole convention that these delegates are part of.
How do you collect your stuff?
Well, the two of us walk around. We have a portfolio that we can put things in. We're just trying to identify people that have things that show some level of activism and engagement that they have, that they brought and made, that they're putting, wearing, you know, holding up as a sign.
Now, do you have to barter with them? Do you have to offer them something? You know, the pen exchange thing is hot at these things.
No, not at all. What we do is we approach them and we explain what we're doing. And surprisingly, people generously make donations to the Smithsonian. And so they'll take off a button or something that they have. If it's something that they can't give at the moment, like their convention hat that they worked 2 weeks making, sometimes they'll actually send it in.
And where can the average citizen see this stuff?
Well, right now, there are a few of these things on display in the American Presidency exhibit and the First Lady's Hall that we have in the Museum on the Mall in Washington. But we're developing a democracy exhibit for a couple of years out from now, so some of this material will appear there.
And how much will you haul back from here?
It's just a small sampling, probably a couple hundred objects, but each one hopefully will express some of what's going on.
Well, thank you both for talking to me.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Jennifer?
Thanks, Debbie, bringing us some color there from Charlotte. E.J. Dion, I had to cut you off. You wanted to say something.
I just wanted to respond to something Ron had said. By the way, I love those Smithsonian people. I've run into them in the primaries. They work really
they work
hard to collect all this stuff. What I was going to say is Ron talked about the loss of public sector jobs, and there's such an irony here because in the Ronald Reagan recovery, Ronald Reagan, the anti-government president, you didn't have state governments cutting back like this. In fact, you had Democrats win the midterm elections, and the public sector job growth helped the recovery that reelected Ronald Reagan. Under Barack Obama, the Democratic president, you have all these cuts going on at the local level, and Obama himself, with his second jobs bill, tried to give more aid to state and local governments, and it didn't come through. So that, yes, we're having private sector job growth. It's still not quick enough, but it's there, and it's being undercut by the declining public sector.
Hmm. Ron Elving, another claim we keep hearing is that Mr. Obama's budget would cut $4 trillion from the debt. What can you tell us about that?
That counts in quite a large contribution from changes that have already been made in the budget since the president was elected in 2008. So that would be a cumulative total of $4 trillion, taking in a lot of things that have already been built into the budget. So it's not a fresh start from the point we're at now. And that 4.5 million jobs we were talking about earlier, that's from the low point of the recession, not from inauguration day of January 2009, but rather from the low point of the recession in 2009. So that's also something that should be factored in. It doesn't go exactly back to the Bush days. It goes back to the low point of the recession that followed during 2009.
Okay. As we've said, we're working our way up to President Obama. Dr. Jill Biden and then the Vice President are coming up before then. Matt, what are you going to be looking for from the President tonight?
Well, you know, I thought it was an interesting comment that Bill Burton made in your interview with him, Jennifer. He said, you know, the president has basically been living on in people's living rooms and on their television screens for the last almost 4 years now. And that's true. And, you know, with any commodity, as the supply increases, the price decreases. That's something Mitt Romney would probably tell us if he were here now. And I think that's true of Obama speaking. Every time he gives another speech, and he's given them a lot of them, the value has decreased. And I have never seen real appreciable influence on public opinion.
Right. He's been criticized for speaking too much sometimes or thinking that a speech can solve all problems. But when he is good, he is good.
I think you're right about that. And I think there is more value to some speeches than others. And convention audiences are not what they used to be,
but
this will still be a very big audience compared to most other speeches.
And right now we can hear the audience applauding for Dr. Jill Biden. She is the wife of Vice President Joe Biden, second lady of the U.S., and an English professor at Northern Virginia Community College. She's kept her job there. She's done a lot of work with Michelle Obama with veterans and travels to military bases. Let's listen to Jill Biden.
What a night, what a crowd. Thank you, Angie. I'm so proud of how far you've come. I'm so proud to stand before you tonight, not only as the wife of our vice president, but as a full-time teacher and a military mom. I'm here for our son, Beau, and for all of our troops, veterans, and military families. 4 years ago, Beau stood on this stage to introduce his father, and soon afterward, he deployed to Iraq for a year with the Delaware Army National Guard. Tonight, thanks to the leadership of President Obama and my husband, Joe, the war in Iraq is over. I'm also here tonight for my students, students like Angie, who work so hard to create a better life for themselves and their families. I've been a teacher for more than 30 years, and to this day, I continue to teach full-time at a community college in Northern Virginia. Not long after Joe was elected vice president, people started questioning whether I could keep teaching. Not Joe. He was there standing by my side saying, "Of course you should. It's who you are, Jill." For me, being a teacher isn't just what I do, it's who I am. These issues are personal to me, and for the more than 37 years that I've known Joe, I've seen firsthand just how personal they are to him, too. Joe often tells people that I didn't agree to marry him until the fifth time he asked me. The truth is, I loved him from the start. I saw in him then the same character that I see in him today. I've seen Joe's character in his optimism. For families who have lost a loved one, kids struggling to find their way, workers out of a job, Joe always works to give people a sense of hope. I've also seen Joe's character in his determination. 2 decades ago, when Joe started working on the Violence Against Women Act, domestic violence was often treated as a private family matter rather than the crime it is. But Joe knew that he had to bring this issue out into the open. And in the year since that bill has passed, I've had women tell me that their sisters or their friends wouldn't be alive today if it weren't for Joe. Finally, I've seen Joe's character in his heart. When I first met him, Joe had already seen just how fragile life could be. When he was 29 years old, Joe lost his first wife and baby daughter in a tragic car accident while they were out getting their Christmas tree, and their boys were critically injured. Joe's life was shattered, but through his strong Catholic faith and his fierce love for our boys, Joe found the strength to get back up. That's Joe. That optimism, that determination, that big, strong heart that drives him forward every day. It's what he learned as a young boy growing up with 2 hardworking parents in Scranton, Pennsylvania. It's what makes him such a loving and supportive father of our three children, Beau, Hunter, and Ashley. And it's what drives him today as he and President Obama fight to strengthen the middle class they grew up in. For as long as I've known him, Joe has never given up, never failed to see the possibilities, and never had any doubt about who he's fighting for. And as long as he has the privilege of serving this nation, I know from the bottom of my heart that he will continue to fight for you every day. Thank you. God bless our troops and God bless our military families. Thank you.
And that was Jill Biden, the second lady of the United States, wife of Vice President Joe Biden, talking about her husband's character, his sense of optimism and hope. This is setting us up now for a retrospective video on the Vice President of the United States. We're going to listen in, and this will be followed by the Vice President himself.
What I like best about this country are the people. There isn't anything we can't do. There still is that feeling in America. That's the part I love about it. My mother thought the most important virtue was courage. She thought everything else flowed from that. And she said, bravery resides in every heart, and someday it's likely to be summoned.
Over the last 4 years, Americans have summoned the bravery that lives in our hearts. One by one, family by family, community by community, fighting through the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Proving once again, there is just no quit in America. Joe Biden understands this. It's what you learn growing up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and Claymont, Delaware.
It was a neat place to grow up. I mean, we thought it was, and still do, think it's completely normal. Four kids, three bedrooms, mom and dad, and of the probably 16 years I lived in that house, there was a relative, at least 14 of those years, living with us full time. My parents never doubted for a second I could be president or vice president, but there's this notion that nobody is better than you. You're no better than anyone else, but nobody's better than you, honey. And in this country, you can be anything you want to be.
And I think that sense of optimism is what he feels for America.
His parents taught him the fundamental truths that make this country special. Basic beliefs that have defined what it has meant to be middle class for generations.
Middle class wasn't a number. It wasn't your net worth. It was more a value set. It's the idea that everyone in this country who works at it can do well, who can own a home, not rent it, be able to live in a safe neighborhood, send their kid to school, help take care of their parents, maybe save enough that they can take care of themselves and not have to rely on their children. That's what this is all about.
But for too many middle-class families, this dream is falling
out
of reach.
This is special coverage of the Democratic National Convention on NPR News. We're listening to a biographical video about Vice President Joe Biden, who will speak in just a few moments.
Up to their child's bedroom to sit on the edge of the bed and say, honey, I'm sorry, but you can't play on the Little League team this summer, and or you can't sing in St. Anne's Choir, or you can't, go to Roosevelt High School. I lost my job. We've got to move. My dad made that walk. Think how many people have made some version of that walk all across America. And they're not looking for a handout. They're just looking for a shot. Just a shot to get back in the game. And I think we owe them that shot.
Giving the middle class a shot has been the cause of this White House. From the moment they took the oath of office, the challenges have been enormous. For this president and vice president, it has been a partnership forged in fire.
It's turned out to be a singular opportunity to be able to work with a guy like Barack Obama because we trust each other. It's a completely candid relationship. I asked him why he wanted me, and he said to help him govern. And so it's been very rewarding, but it's been most rewarding watching him. This guy has an incredible amount of character. is a backbone like a ramrod. He makes his judgments based upon what he thinks is good for the country. The last questions he asks are the political consequences of it.
Joe has been a great partner and a great vice president. He cares about the middle class. He knows what it's like to struggle, and he's carried that passion to the White House.
Every step of the way, they have met the challenge. Preventing an economic collapse, rescuing the auto industry, passing historic health care reform, eliminating bin Laden, ending the war in Iraq. And through it all, they have put the interests of the nation first.
Really and truly, Barack and I are about growing this economy from the middle out. Because when you do it that way, everybody does well. Poor folks have a ladder up. There's a way into the middle class, those who are striving to get in the middle class. And the wealthy do very well because the middle class have money in their pockets. They can go out and purchase things that make the economy grow. It not only is sort of the American way, it's also economically the best way to grow a country. Give them a tax system that's basically fair. Give their kids an opportunity for an education. Provide an environment where they can flourish.
Maybe it's because he's never forgotten where he came from that he's never lost sight of where we need to go.
He has such a sense of justice and fairness to him. And I think that makes him fight even harder for people.
Maybe it's because he's known loss and pain in his own life that he's never been blind to the suffering of others.
I think that's one of the things that Joe has that a lot of people don't have, the sense of intuition. He intuitively feels someone's pain. He did know what it feels like to lose a wife and then the unspeakable, to lose a child. And I think that's why people connect with him.
He's always shown that he's been a man that supports the working class.
He really cares for you.
He's absolutely here for us. He's listening.
Yes, he is, and I'm going to get a chocolate cone. Here, Roger.
Hey, Roger, this is Joe Biden.
Biden! Biden! Biden!
Maybe it's because he's never doubted the American people that he's never doubted America's future.
It's never been a safe bet to bet against America. I know I get criticized for saying that to foreign leaders, but I will not stop saying it. It's never been a good bet to bet against America.
We're in a fight for the middle class, and there's nobody I'd rather have in that fight with me than Joe Biden.
He's the husband of a teacher who knows teachers should be lifted up, not torn down. He's the son of an auto man who never doubted the American auto industry would once again roar. He's the author of the Violence Against Women Act, who's had the courage to stand against the abuse of power his whole career. He's the father of an Iraq war veteran who believes our one sacred obligation is to take care of those who have served this nation.
I can say with absolute certitude, I am more optimistic about America's chances today than I have been my entire life.
Grit, determination, resilience, optimism. That's been the story of America. The story of ordinary people with extraordinary courage, overcoming extraordinary obstacles, and always, always moving towards a better day. Joe Biden knows that story. He's lived it. Our Vice President, Joe Biden.
A biographical video there, and next up is the Vice President of the U.S., Joe Biden. He is a former U.S. senator elected at age 29, served six terms. He is the first vice president to be Roman Catholic and from Delaware, and he heads the White House Task Force on Working Families. So the middle class has been very much his focus these past 4 years. The crowd is giving him a warm welcome there in Charlotte, North Carolina. Vice President Joe Biden at the convention in Charlotte.
Hey, Delaware. Hello, my fellow Democrats. And my favorite Democrat, Jilly, I want you to know that Bo and Hunt and Ashley and I, we're so incredibly proud of you, kid. You know, we admire the way when every single solitary young person, and they're not all young, walk into your classroom, you not only teach them, you give them confidence. You give me confidence. And the passion she brings to trying to ease the burden on the families of our warriors. Jilly, they know you understand them, and that makes a gigantic difference. And folks, I tell you what, it was worth the trip to hear my wife say what I've never heard her say before. She's always loved me. If that's the case, why in the heck did it take five times of asking you? And that's true, five times. I don't know what I would have done, kiddo, had you on that fifth time said no. I love you. You're the love of my life and the life of my love. We've got three incredible kids. And Bo, I want to thank you for putting my name and nomination to be Vice President of the United States. I accept. I accept. With great honor and pleasure, I accept. Thank you. Thank you, my fellow Democrats. And I say to my fellow Americans, 4 years ago, a battered nation turned away from the failed policies of the past and turned to a leader who they knew would lift our nation out of the crisis. A journey we haven't finished yet. We know we still have more to do, but today, I say to my fellow citizens, in the face of the deepest economic crisis in our lifetime, this generation of Americans has proven itself as worthy as any generation before us. For we possess that same grit, that same determination, that same courage that has always defined what it means to be an American, has always defined all of you. Together, we're on a mission. We're on a mission to move this nation forward from doubt and downturn to promise and prosperity. A mission I guarantee you we will complete. A mission we will complete. Folks, tonight what I really want to do is tell you about my friend Barack Obama. No one could tell it as well or as eloquently as Michelle, as you did last night, Michelle, on Monday night. But I know him, to state the obvious, from a different perspective. I know him. And I want to show you, I want to show you the character of a leader who had what it took when the American people literally stood on the brink of a new depression. A leader who has what it takes to lead us over the next 4 years to a future as great as our people. I want to take you inside the White House to see the president as I see him every day. Because I don't see him in sound bites. I walk 30 paces down the hall into the Oval Office, and I see him. I watch him in action. 4 years ago, the middle class was already losing ground, and then the bottom fell out. The financial crisis hit like a sledgehammer on all the people I grew up with. You remember the headlines. You saw some of them in the previews. Highlight. Highest job losses in 60 years. Headlines. Economy on the brink. Markets plummet worldwide. From the very moment President Obama sat behind the desk resolute in the Oval Office, he knew. He knew he had not only to restore the confidence of a nation, but he had to restore the confidence of the whole world. And he also knew that one false move could bring a run on the banks or a credit collapse to put another several million people out of work. America and the world needed a strong president with a steady hand and with the judgment and vision to see us through. Day after day, night after night, I sat beside him as he made one gutsy decision after the other to stop the slide and reverse it. I watched him stand up to intense pressure and stare down enormous challenges, the consequences of which were awesome. But most of all, I got to see firsthand what drove this man, his profound concern for the average American. He knew that no matter how tough the decisions he had to make were in that Oval Office, he knew that families all over America, sitting at their kitchen tables, were literally making decisions for their family that were equally as consequential. You know, Barack and I, we've been through a lot together in these 4 years, and we learned about one another, a lot about one another. And one of the things I learned about Barack is the enormity of his heart, and I think he learned about me the depth of my loyalty to him. And there's another thing that has bound us together these past 4 years. We had a pretty good idea what all those families, all you Americans in trouble, were going through, in part because our own families had gone through similar struggles. Barack, as a young man, had to sit at the end of his mother's hospital bed and watch her fight with her insurance company at the very same time she was fighting for her life. When I was a young kid in third grade, I remember my dad coming up the stairs of my grandpa's house where we were living, sitting at the end of my bed and saying, "Joey, I'm going to have to leave for a while. Go down to Wilmington, Delaware with Uncle Frank. There are good jobs down there, honey. And in a little while, I'll be able to send for you and Mom and Jimmy and Val, and everything's going to be fine." For the rest of our life, my sister and my brothers, for the rest of our life, my dad never failed to remind us that a job is about a lot more than a paycheck. It's about your dignity. It's about respect. It's about your place in the community. It's about being able to look your child in the eye and say, "Honey, it's going to be okay," and mean it. And no, it's true. When Barack and I were growing up, there was an implicit understanding in America that if you took responsibility, you'd get a fair shot at a better life. And the values behind that bargain were the values that shaped both of us and many, many of you. And today, those same values are Barack's guiding star. Folks, I've watched him. He has never wavered. He never, never backs down. He always steps up, and he always asks in every one of those critical meetings the same fundamental question. How is this going to affect the average American? How is this going to affect people's lives? That's what's inside this man. That's what makes him tick. That's who he is. And folks, because of the decisions he has made and the incredible strength of the American people, America has turned the corner. The worst job loss since the Great Depression. We've since created 4.5 million private sector jobs in the past 29 months. Look, folks. President Obama and Governor Romney, they're both loving husbands. They're both devoted fathers. But let's be straight. They bring a vastly different vision and a vastly different value set to the job. And tonight, although you've heard people talk about it, I want to talk about two things from a slightly different perspective, from my perspective. I'd like to focus on two crises and show you the character of the leadership that each man will bring to this job. Because, as I said, I've had a ringside seat. The first of these, a lot's been talked about. And God love Jennifer Granholm. Wasn't she great? Wasn't she great? I love Jennifer. But the first story I want to talk to you about is the rescue of the automobile industry. And let me tell you from this man's ringside seat, let me tell you about how Barack Obama saved more than a million American jobs. In the first days that we took office, General Motors and Chrysler were literally on the verge of liquidation. If the president didn't act, if he didn't act immediately, there wouldn't be any industry left to save. So we sat hour after hour in the Oval Office. Michelle remembers what he must have thought when he came back upstairs. We sat hour after hour. We listened to senators, congressmen, outside advisors, even some of our own advisors. And we listened to them to say some of the following things. They said, well, we shouldn't step up. The risks were too high. The outcome was too uncertain. And the president, he patiently sat there and he listened. But he didn't see it the way they did. He understood something they didn't get, and one of the reasons I love him. He understood that this wasn't just about cars. It was about the people who built and made those cars. And about the America those people built. In those meetings, I often thought about my dad. My dad was an automobile man. He would have been one of those guys all the way down the line, not in the factory floor, not along the supply chain, but one of those guys who were selling American cars to American people. I thought about what this crisis would have meant for the mechanics and the secretaries and the salespeople who my dad managed for over 35 years. And I know for certain that my dad, were he here today, he'd be fighting like heck for the president, because the president fought to save the jobs of those people my dad cared so much about. Ladies and gentlemen, my dad respected Barack Obama, would have respected Barack Obama had he been around, for having had the guts to stand up for the automobile industry when so many others just were prepared to walk away. You know, when I look back now, When I look back on the president's decision, I think of another son of another automobile man, Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney grew up in Detroit. My dad managed, his dad owned, his dad ran an entire automobile company, American Motors. Yes, what I don't understand is, in spite of that, he was willing to let Detroit go bankrupt. Look, I don't think he's a bad guy. No, I don't think he's a bad guy. I'm sure he grew up loving cars as much as I did. But what I don't understand, what I don't think he understood, I don't think he understood that saving the automobile worker, saving the industry, what it meant to all of America, not just auto workers. I think he saw it the Bain way. Now, I mean this sincerely. I think he saw it in terms of balance sheets and write-offs. Folks, the Bain way may bring your firm the highest profits, but it's not the way to lead our country from the highest office.
This is special coverage of the Democratic National Convention from NPR News.
When things hung in the balance, I mean literally hung in the balance, the president understood this was about a lot more than the automobile industry. This was about restoring America's pride. He understood in his gut what it would mean to leave a million people without hope or work if he didn't act. And he also knew, he intuitively understood the message it would have sent around the world if the United States gave up on an industry that helped put America on the map in the first place. Conviction, resolve, Barack Obama, that's what saved the automobile industry. Conviction, resolve, Barack Obama. Look, I heard my friend John Kerry. This president has shown the same resolve, the same steady hand in his role as commander-in-chief. Look, which brings me to the next illustration I want to tell you about, the next crisis he had to face. In 2008, before he was president, Barack Obama made a promise to the American people. He said, if we have bin Laden in our sights, we will take him out. He went on to say, that has to be our biggest national security priority. Look, Barack understood that the search for bin Laden was about a lot more than taking a monstrous leader off the battlefield. It was about so much more than that. It was about righting an unspeakable wrong. It was about healing an unbearable wound, a nearly unbearable wound in America's heart. And he also knew the message we had to send around the world. If you attack innocent Americans, we will follow you to the end of the earth. Look, most of all, most of all, President Obama had an unyielding faith in the capacity and the capability of our special forces, literally the finest warriors in the history of the world, So we sat We sat originally only five of us. We sat in the Situation Room beginning in the fall of the year before. We listened, we talked, we heard, and he listened to the risks and reservations about the raid. He asked again the tough questions. He listened to the doubts that were expressed. But when Admiral McRaven looked him in the eye and said, "Sir, we can get this job done," I sit next to him. I looked at your husband, and I knew at that moment he had made his decision. And his response was decisive. He said, "Do it," and justice was done. Folks, Governor Romney didn't see things that way. When he was asked about bin Laden in 2007, here's what he said. He said, "It's not worth moving heaven and earth and spending billions of dollars just to catch one person." But he was wrong. He was wrong. Because if you understood that America's heart had to be healed, you would have done exactly what the president did, and you would move heaven and earth to hunt him down and to bring him to justice. Look, 4 years ago, 4 years ago, only thing missing at this convention this year is my mom. 4 years ago, my mom was still with us, sitting up in the stadium in Denver. I quoted her, one of her favorite expressions. She used to say to all her children, she said, "Joey, bravery resides in every heart, and the time will come when it must be summoned." Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you what I think you already know, but I watch it up close. Bravery resides in the heart of Barack Obama, and time again, I witnessed him summon it. This man has courage in his soul, compassion in his heart, and a spine of steel. And because of all the actions he took, because of the calls he made, because of the determination of American workers and the unparalleled bravery of our special forces, we can now proudly say what you've heard me say the last 6 months. Osama bin Laden is dead and General Motors is alive. That's right. One man. Folks, we know we have more work to do. We know we're not there yet. But not a day has gone by in the last 4 years when I haven't been grateful as an American that Barack Obama is our president, because he always has the courage to make the tough decision. Speaking of tough calls, last week we heard at the Republican convention, we heard our opponents, we heard them pledge that they too had the courage to make the tough calls. That's what they said. But folks, in case you didn't notice, I say to my fellow Americans, in case you didn't notice, they didn't have the courage to tell you what calls they'd make. They never mentioned any of that. Mrs. Robinson, you watched from home, I guess, from the White House. You heard them talk so much about how they cared so much about Medicare, how much they wanted to preserve it. That's what they told you. But let's look at what they didn't tell you. What they didn't tell you is that the plan they have already put down on paper would immediately cut benefits from more than 30 million seniors already on Medicare. What they didn't tell you, what they didn't tell you, is the plan they are proposing would cause Medicare to go bankrupt by 2016. And what they really didn't tell you is they, if you want to know, if you want to know, they're not for preserving Medicare at all. They're for a new plan. It's called voucher care. Look, folks, that's not courage. That's not even truthful. That's not even truthful. In Tampa, they talk with great urgency about the nation's debt and the need to act now. But not once, not one single time, did they tell you that they rejected every plan put forward by us, by the bipartisan Simpson-Bowles Commission they referenced, or by any other respected group to reduce the national debt. They were not for any of them. Why? Because they're not prepared to do anything about the debt if it contained even $1, I'm not exaggerating, even $1 or 1 cent in new taxes for millionaires. Folks, that's not courage and that's not fair. Look, look. In a sense, this can be reduced to a single notion. The two men seeking to lead this country over the next 4 years, as I said at the outset, have fundamentally different visions and completely different value set. Governor Romney believes in this global economy, it doesn't matter much where American companies invest and put their money or where they create jobs. As a matter of fact, in his budget proposal, in his tax proposal, he calls for a new tax. It's called a territorial tax, which the experts have looked at, and they acknowledge it will create 800,000 new jobs, all of them overseas, all of them. And what I found fascinating, the most fascinating thing I found last week was when Governor Romney said that as president, he would take a jobs tour. Well, with his support for outsourcing, it's going to have to be a foreign trip. It will. Look, President Obama knows that creating jobs in America, keeping jobs in America, bringing jobs back to America is what the president's job was all about. That's what presidents do, or at least supposed to do. Folks, Governor Romney believes it's okay to raise taxes on middle classes by $2,000 in order to pay for another, literally another trillion-dollar tax cut for the very wealthy. President Obama knows that there's nothing decent or fair about asking people with more to do less and with less to do more. Governor Romney believes, he believes that kids like our dreamers, those immigrant children who were brought to America's shores through no fault of their own, he thinks they're a drag on the American economy. President Obama believes that even though those dreamers, those kids, didn't choose to come here, they have chosen to do right by America, and it's time for us to do right by them. Governor Romney. Governor Romney looks at the notion of equal pay in terms of a company's bottom line. President Obama, he knows that making sure our daughters get the same pay for the same jobs as our son is every father's bottom line. Look. I kind of expected all that from them, but one thing truly perplexed me at their convention. The thing that perplexed me most was this idea they kept talking about the culture of dependency. They seem to think You create a culture of dependency when you provide a bright, young, qualified kid from a working-class family a loan to get to college, or when you provide a job training program in a new industry for a dad who lost his job because it was outsourced. Folks, that's not how we look at it. That's not how America's ever looked at it. What he doesn't understand is all these men and women are looking for is a chance, just a chance to acquire the skills to be able to provide for their families so they can once again hold their heads high and lead independent lives with dignity. That's all they're looking for. Look. And it literally amazes me they don't understand that. You know, I told you at the outset, the choice is stark. Two different visions, two different value sets. But at its core, the difference is able to reduce to be a fundamental difference. You see, most Americans, have incredible faith in the decency and hard work of the American people. And we know what has made this country. It's the American people. As I mentioned at the outset, 4 years ago, we were hit hard. You saw your retirement accounts drained, the equity in your homes vanished, jobs lost or on the line. But what did you do as Americans? What you've always done. You didn't lose faith. You fought back. You didn't give up. You got up. You're the ones. The American people, you're the ones. You're the reason why we are still better positioned than any country in the world to lead the 21st century. You never quit on America, and you deserve a president who will never quit on you.
This is special coverage of the Democratic National Convention from NPR News. We're listening to Vice President Joe Biden.
Folks, there's one more thing. One more thing. Our Republican opponents are just dead wrong about. America is not in decline. America is not in decline. I've got news for Governor Romney and Congressman Ryan. Gentlemen, it never makes sense. It's never been a good bet to bet against the American people. Never. My fellow Americans, America is coming back, and we're not going back. And we have no intention of downsizing the American dream. Never. Never a good bet. Ladies and gentlemen, In a moment, we're going to hear from a man whose whole life is a testament to the power of that dream and whose presidency is the best hope to secure that dream for our children. For you see, we see a future. We really, honest to God, do. We see a future where everyone, rich and poor, does their part and has a part, a future where we depend more on clean energy from home and less on oil from abroad, a future where we're number one in the world again in college graduation, a future where we promote the private sector, not the privileged sector, and a future where women once again control their own choices, their destiny, and their own health care. And ladies and gentlemen, Brock and I see a future. It's in our DNA where no one is forced to live in the shadows of intolerance. Folks, we see a future where America leads not only by the example of our power, but by the power of our example, where we bring our troops home from Afghanistan just as we proudly did from Iraq. A future where we fulfill the only truly sacred obligation we have as a nation. The only truly sacred obligation we have is to prepare those who we send to war and care for them when they come home from war. And tonight, I want to acknowledge, as we should every night, the incredible debt we owe to the families of those 6,473 fallen angels, and those 49,746 wounded, thousands critically, thousands who will need our help for the rest of their lives. Folks, we must never, ever forget their sacrifice and always keep them in our care and in our prayers. My fellow Americans, we now find ourselves at the hinge of history. And the direction we turn is not figuratively, it is literally in your hands. It has been a truly great honor to serve you and to serve with Barack, who has always stood up with you for the past 4 years. I've seen him tested. I know his strength, his command, his faith. And I also know the incredible confidence he has in all of you. I know this man. Yes, the work of recovery is not yet complete, but we are on our way. The journey of hope is not yet finished, but we are on our way. And the cause of change is not fully accomplished, but we are on our way. So I say to you tonight, with absolute confidence, America's best days are ahead, and yes, we are on our way. And in light of that horizon, for the values that define us, for the ideals that inspire us, there is only one choice. That choice is to move forward, boldly forward, and finish the job and re-elect President Barack Obama. God bless you all, and may God protect our troops. God bless you. Thank you.
And that was Vice President Joe Biden giving a rousing defense of President Barack Obama, saying what drives him is his profound concern for average Americans. He says he and Mr. Romney have fundamentally different visions and value sets. He said Mr. Obama has courage in his soul, compassion in his heart, a spine of steel, and he contrasted him with Mr. Romney on two key decisions, the decision to carry out the auto bailout when Mitt Romney said GM should be allowed to go bankrupt, and his decision to go after Osama bin Laden when Mr. Romney had said that didn't make sense. Vice President Joe Biden, we have NPR's Debbie Elliott on the floor there with the Delaware delegation. Hi, Debbie.
Yes, hi, Jennifer. I'm in the Delaware delegation, and I'm with the chairman of the party from Delaware, John Daniello.
Yes, ma'am.
What did you think of Mr. Biden?
He's the Joe Biden that I have known for some 38, 40 years, and he was probably better tonight than he's been in those 40 years.
Now, you all served together on the county council back in the 70s, I understand.
Well, I was just coming off, and Joe was just going on the county council.
He made a forceful argument for President Obama tonight.
And I think very well. It was our turn, and if anybody can get a message across, as you can well see, Joe could do it.
What do you think the delegates will take away from this tonight? And, you know, he seemed to be putting a personal touch on President Obama for the delegates.
Well, that obviously we need. There's been talk in the media that we don't have the energy this time that we had in 08. I think that's plain nonsense by what you see right now. I think both Mr. Obama and Joe showing it. When we get back to Delaware, I won't have any trouble finding volunteers and getting people to work for that ticket.
Thank you for speaking with me. And Jennifer, I guess we should go back to the podium now where Illinois Senator Dick Durbin is about to introduce President Obama.
In a name that was hard to pronounce, Loretta and Michelle and I stood on the side of the stage in Boston and wondered if you would accept his message about the future of this party, and you did. 4 years later, 4 years later in Denver, I asked you to give this man our party's nomination for president. And tonight in Charlotte, I ask you to join me in giving President Barack Obama 4 more years to finish the job he started. I was there. Four more years. Now, I was there. Many of you were with me. It was a cold, cold January afternoon when Barack Obama lifted his hand from Abraham Lincoln's Bible and looked out on an America facing an economic collapse. These last 4 years have been hard. Too many families are still struggling. But today, our economy is beginning to recover. Jobs are returning. Businesses are expanding. America is coming back. Our friends in the other party gathered in Tampa and gave us a message last week. They said, just remember, we're all in this alone. Yeah. They told us the real winners, the real builders, never need a helping hand. Democrats know better. America knows better. History and this president have shown us we are stronger when we are all in this together. I invite them. Come to Belvedere, Illinois. Meet 5,000 proud Chrysler UAW workers. One business leader who has been referenced a few times tonight said, let them go bankrupt. Barack Obama said, let them go back to work, and they did. Come and meet the working families all across America who now have a chance for affordable health care. At one time, a governor thought that was a good idea in Massachusetts. Well, President Obama and millions of American families think it's a great idea for America. But this president is focused on more than just opportunity. He has focused on justice. I am proud to have been there when he signed his first bill as president of the United States to end discrimination against women in the workplace in honor of Lilly Ledbetter. And I will tell you, I cannot remember a more touching ceremony than when this president gathered us together to finally eliminate the discrimination of don't ask, don't tell in our military. It was 11 years ago. 11 years ago, I introduced a little bill known as the DREAM Act. And I will tell you, my life has been changed by the inspiration of these young men and women who simply want to earn their way into America. We have fought the filibusters in the Senate, but we are lucky. It took President Obama to finally bring these young people out of the shadows into the America that they have always called home. It was 150 years ago, that another president from Illinois brought justice to his day with the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, his critics told him he had gone way too far. and he should undo what he'd done. But here's what Abraham Lincoln said. I hope to stand firm enough not to go backwards. We cannot build a better, stronger, fairer America by going backwards. We must walk forward together. And with President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden in the White House, we will. President Obama, your values, your vision, your commitment to justice are still worth fighting for. Thank you.
And that was Dick Durbin, the Senate Democratic Whip and a senior senator from Illinois. He served with President Obama and was an early supporter of his presidential bid in 2008, praising a number of the president's policies.